our 230 docket. We have only one case on the 230 docket, 07CA1971, in the matter of the petition of DIS. I see council moving to council's tables. Council, have you received the written instructions and have you read them? Do you have any questions about those instructions? You'll each have 15 minutes. Appellant, you'll see the clock counting down, and you can reserve whatever time you want for your rebuttal. Everyone in the courtroom, please make sure your cell phones are turned off.
Thank you, and may it please the court, my name is Dan West, and I represent the appellants in this case who are the parents of the subject child. Today we are asking that you reverse the trial court's denial of their motion to terminate the guardianship that was granted with respect to their son. In the alternative, we're asking that you remand the matter back to the trial court for application of what we believe is the appropriate standard as set forth in CA in the Troxell versus Granville case. Specifically, we believe that what the court should have done in this case was give special weight or special significance to the parents' wishes, that a presumption in their favor regarding their wishes to the care, custody, and control of the child, and that that presumption was only rebuttable by clear and convincing evidence that their decision with respect to the child was not in his best interest. Now, when we did our briefs in this case, I think we raised a lot of issues of first impression before this court. And I'm well aware of the MJK case, which I'm sure the court is as well, that came down in November. And so I want to talk about that case a lot and talk about two things. One is I think our case is very distinguishable from the MJK case. And two is that I'm going to respectfully submit that I don't think MJK was properly decided. I'm well aware that when a case comes out in November, this court is not apt to find that, to not agree with that reasoning. But I do think there's some persuasive issues that says that that's really not what the law should be in this state. But with respect to distinguishing the MJK case from this case, the MJK court made it very clear that one of the biggest issues for them was the guardianships, the underlying guardianships and custody orders in those cases. There was no indication that they were meant to be temporary. That's not the case here. And what we have to do is look back to the original proceedings in this case when guardianship was ultimately granted. The consents that my client signed specifically said they were temporary, and they were only agreeing to temporary custody or to temporary guardianship. Then the hearing takes place, and Magistrate Feeney makes it clear that the term permanent is really just a term of art. It doesn't really mean permanent, and that's what he says. It's a term of art, and explains to him what the effect of that is. And he says, regardless of the language contained in the consent that he signed about temporary guardianship, I think really Alan understands that permanent guardianship, by that I mean, and there's a lot of inaudibles in here, point as stated earlier, Alan Sherrill decide if they want to have the guardianship reviewed, amend it, alter it, change it, or terminate it, basically have to bring it back to the court. Now that would be one thing if that's all he said, but he went on, and he assured Alan Sidman of something. And he says, just to give you some assurances, Alan, Mr. Finkelstein's presentation of the law is accurate. Guardianships are generally, there are a few wrinkles, but generally they are consensual in nature. And if at some point in the future, you neither one withdraw your consent for the guardianship because you now think it's better for Daniel to come back with you and Cheryl, or just so the situation could be, and assuming you are able and willing to take care of Daniel, circumstances allow you to do that, then by definition, our statute's physical guardianship would cease to exist. That's what the court told my client. And so he consented to it. And I would analogize this to a criminal case. And I think the court would have a problem if a judge in a criminal case told the defendant, listen, I tell you what, if you'll plead guilty to this charge, I'll just sentence you to probation. The defendant pleads guilty to the charge. The judge turns around and says, nah, I changed my mind. I'm going to go ahead and sentence you to jail. That's what's happened here. And we're talking about a fundamental liberty interest in both of those cases, both here when we're talking about the care, custody, and control of a child, and the defendant in a criminal case. And so I think this case is distinguishable from the MJK case because there is very much an indication that the reason that my clients, the parents, were consenting to the guardianship was their understanding that it was only temporary in nature. And if they ever wanted to come back and change their mind about it, they could. The MJ case, K case, a couple other distinguishing factors from that case is that, in that case, the court made a lot about the fact that the mother had actually was co-petitioner in the case. That's not the case here. My clients were not the co-petitioners. They were the respondents. They, and understandably, they did consent, but they said they were consenting to a temporary. They agreed to a permanent once it was explained to them, that if they ever wanted to come back, they could change their mind. The MJK case also made a lot about the fact that the mother in that case had relinquished her day-to-day role as a parent. The transcript in this case is replete with references that these people maintained an active role in this child's life. They paid for everything. They reimbursed the guardians for every cent that they had. Granted, their contact was not that consistent for a time period, but there was some mental health issues with Ms. Sidman that prevented that from happening. As soon as they were able to, then the visitation started a lot more. So understandably, they're not taking care of the child day to day, and I understand that, but they are providing for the child's needs. And again, my second point is, even if you don't feel like this case can be distinguished from the MJK case, I do think for a couple of reasons that the MJK case respectfully was wrongfully decided, and I understand it wasn't this panel who decided that case, but the MJK court relied on In Re the Guardianship and LV, which was a California case, and interestingly is the same case that our trial court relied on here. What the LV court said, that California court said, was you don't have that fundamental right anymore because the child wasn't in your care anymore. So therefore, there's no more fundamental liberty interest provided. That's not the law in Colorado. And I would cite, and I cited the CCRS case, which I think is a 1995 Supreme Court case, Colorado Supreme Court case. And in that case, it was very clear that the mother of the child, still had the presumption in her favor. She still had that liberty interest. And the child in that case was in the care of the prospective adoptive couple. I grant you that it wasn't a custody order, but it was a custody arrangement. In the LV case, it was just the fact that the child was not in the care of the parent. And I think what you do is if we follow the MJK case, you basically turn in every custody order and every guardianship that grants a non-parent custody or guardianship, you turn that into a de facto adoption. And that's not what these are supposed to be for. And I cited a bunch of precedent from other states, and clearly there's the LV case and there's other cases that support that line, but there's a lot of cases that support our position on this case. And the one, and I want to apologize for citing from it in such length, but I really thought it really got to the heart of why the policy reasons were that we don't turn these into a de facto adoptions, that you don't give up your fundamental liberty interest by giving somebody guardianship. And I'm not going to quote the whole thing, but it says, guardianships are intended to encourage parents experiencing difficulties to temporarily turn over custody and care of their children, safe in the knowledge that they will be able to regain custody in the future. The policy would be frustrated if guardianships were permanent or resulted in the automatic termination of parental rights, because parents would be less likely to voluntarily petition for a guardian to be appointed to care for their minor children. I think that there no person who ever wanted their child back would ever allow somebody to take guardianship of them, because at that point you have the burden of proof. And it just, the Troxel court didn't say that parents have a fundamental liberty interest only if they have care and control of their child. It doesn't say that. It says parents. They're still parents until their rights are terminated. Their rights were never terminated. And if their rights haven't been terminated, they're still a parent, and they're still entitled to the fundamental liberty interest promised to them by the U.S. Supreme Court in Troxel and also our Colorado Supreme Court in CA.
Mr. West, what do we do with the court's language where the court says, regardless of the language contained in the consent form that Alan signed about temporary guardianship, I think really Alan understands that inaudible permanent guardianship. However, the word permanent, as our legislature has used it in this case, really is, again, inaudible. By that I mean that, as I stated earlier, if they decide that they want it reviewed, amended, basically, they have to bring it before the court, and the court will decide.
And if that's all he had said, I don't think we would be having much of an argument today. But that is not all he said. What he said is, let me just assure you, Alan, by basis under our law, if you decide you don't want to consent anymore and you're capable of caring for the child, and there's never been a question that Mr. Sidman was capable of caring for the child, this ceases to exist pursuant to our laws. Now, and I know that the law of the case doctrine is a discretionary doctrine, but if there's ever a situation where it should be enforced, this has got to be it. This is an abuse of discretion. To tell somebody who's clearly under a lot of strain, a lot of pressure, has a lot of questions about what he's agreeing to, and has both the attorney on the other side and a judge tell him the effect of that, and he's okay with the effect of that, and then turn around a few years later and say, no, 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 Magistrate Feeney was wrong. Here's the real standard. You've got to prove it to us.
Was Mr. Sidman represented by counsel at the time you're talking about here?
He was not, Your Honor. He was pro se. And Ms. Sidman was not there. And that's a different issue entirely. And the court did find, with respect to Ms. Sidman, that she was unable to care for the child as well, as unwilling to care for the child, which is the standard of the statute. But what's really important to note is the court's finding on our motion to terminate guardianship, and that was, mom is able to parent this child. And I think that's real important. If you agree with my law of the case doctrine, then you can just reverse the trial court. Now, I don't think anybody thinks it's in the best interest of the child to just stop. And I mean, a reunification plan is what we always proposed in the trial court. We understood that the best interest of the child has to be taken into account. And the MJK court kind of concluded that, well, gee, we can't just have these parents coming back in and taking their children. Well, I don't think that would be the case. You'd always have to have it here. You just provide the parents with the presumption. If a lot of time had gone by, certainly a lot of courts are going to say, well, I think that presumption's been rebutted, and I'm not going to change the guardianship. All we're asking is that they be afforded their fundamental liberty interest. I talked a little bit in my brief about whether or not the original magistrate had subject matter jurisdiction to hear the case. And if you look at the transcript, the guardians are there at the beginning of the hearing. They're asked if they consent to the guardians, the district court magistrate hearing the case. Alan Sidman comes on later, and that same request is not made of him. And that's real important because really he's the one giving up the rights here. And he's not told that he can ask for a hearing before a district court judge. The issue then becomes, and clearly the magistrate rules say that he had to get consent, is the fact that it was a requirement, does that make it subject matter jurisdiction? And if it is subject matter jurisdiction, it can be raised at any time. I would submit to you that it is a subject matter jurisdiction issue, and therefore that original order was void. Since I have some time, I'm just going to address real quick Dr. Gomberg's testimony at the hearing, and then I'll reserve the rest of my time. A cross appeal was made that the court should not have allowed Dr. Gomberg's testimony in. I don't think that issue was preserved. The question was asked initially and objected to is she capable of parenting a child? That was objected to. The court instructed me to lay more of a foundation. I then did that, and no objection was made to my question, is Cheryl Sidman psychologically able to parent a child? The guy had been in therapy with them. He was qualified as a psychologist. It was clearly relevant. I don't know of any objectionable piece. And that becomes important, I think. I think the reason why the appellees think that's important is, well, gee, then the trial court's finding that mother was capable of parenting the child goes away, but it doesn't. There's a lot of evidence that supported that conclusion, not just Dr. Gomberg's testimony. With that, I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. You have just over 2 minutes.
May it please the court, Leo Finkelstein on behalf of the appellees, Michael and Renee Sidman. There's some important facts that I think the court needs to understand that underlie this case. Daniel is almost 10. He's been with his guardians since he was 19 months old, May of 2001. He's been out of his parents' care even longer, since he was 9 months old. He was first placed with grandparents for a short period of time. The child and family investigator was a licensed psychologist here in the Denver metropolitan area. He did a thorough report that's in the record. The mother in this case has not only never cared for the child by herself, she's had mental issues her entire life, and the CFI went through them in quite some detail, and they are significant. And I'm going to be very brief on this point. She was hospitalized in 1992 with major depressive illness. She was again hospitalized in 1996 and appeared psychotic. Upon admission to the hospital, required physical restraint and chemical restraint. In 2000, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and postpartum depression. Shortly thereafter, as you know, they allowed the child to be placed with the grandparents and then with the aunt and uncle here in Colorado. She had suicidal thoughts and had to receive electroshock treatments. And then when we get to the issue that you raised with appellant's counsel on temporary versus permanent, things happened. There's in his discussions with Alan Sidman in the record, if you read the transcript by the court, and I'm reading from page 16, a different page from page 20, which you had read from. He's talking to Alan Sidman. Temporary guardianships are by definition only last for 6 months of a child. However, what I think I heard you testify a few moments ago is that you really understand this is going to be a permanent guardianship, but that if at some point down the road your situation changes, or more specifically Cheryl's, that's the mother's, situation changes, you would like to have the opportunity to ask that the guardianship terminate at that point. The court would consider allowing Daniel to come back and live with you. And then he goes on to what Judge Paparelli indicated later on, in which he says that if you decide you want to have this guardianship reviewed, amend it, alter it, change it, or terminate it, as Mr. Finkelstein pointed out, basically you have to bring it back before the court, and the court will look at that and make a decision. So the court has continuing jurisdiction. Children grow up. Things change. In 2003, the mother had a first of all, they didn't come back in 6 months or in 1 year or in 2 years. They came back 5 years later in 2006. And things change. The child grows up. In 2003, the mother was arrested for carjacking, armed robbery, assault to murder, assault with battery with a dangerous weapon, resisting arrest, negligent operation of a motor vehicle, and speeding. What happened is she had paranoid suspicion and delusions. She had a psychotic break. She felt that there was conspiracy, fears, beliefs that the police were about to murder her. She caused her to jump out of a car with her husband, hijack another motorist's car, and lead the police down a stretch of the Massachusetts Turnpike or another highway. I'm not positive it was the Turnpike, but a major highway in Massachusetts on a police chase.
Mr. Finkelstein, doesn't this evidence go to the magistrate and the district court's determination of whether or not a change in the guardianship arrangement or termination thereof would be in the best interest of the child?
It and does.
I don't believe that counsel, the way I understand, I don't believe that the parent's counsel is arguing the sufficiency of the evidence in this case as to whether or not it's in the best interest to be returned to the parents. He's arguing a burden of proof theory, that the burden of proof should be on the guardians to show by clear and convincing evidence that it would be in the best interest of the child to maintain the guardianship.
I will then address that burden of proof argument.
Thank you.
That is his main argument. The parents in this case consented to the guardianship and admitted that they were unable or unwilling to care for the child. Their written consents are in the record. At that point, on hearing this case, the magistrate, who, by the way, the second magistrate heard this with consent, felt that the presumption that the parents had a first and prior right to custody was overcome, in our legal words, would be rebutted, by the evidence that established that the welfare and best interest of the child was better served by continuing the guardianship with the aunt and uncle due to issues such as stability of the relationship and the fact that the child identifies the aunt and uncle as his parental figures. The evidence in terms of those best interests, the child was well adjusted in his home environment. He identified the aunt and uncle as his parental figures. He spent 5 of 7 then, now it's 7 of 9 years with his guardians. There was reference to the mother's long history of mental illness. The magistrate found she had a virtually non-existent relationship with the child. And in point of fact, she's never been with the child alone in her lifetime. The father was with her during the first 9 months. He took her home from work when the child was an infant. The parents did not make the relationship with the child their paramount concern. The father's relationship with the child was found by the court to be more avuncular, like an uncle, than that of a parent. And most importantly, the CFI, the licensed psychologist, testified that removing the child from the guardians would be traumatic for the child, and that he would likely experience long-term impairments in his ability to function interpersonally. So the factors that this court found in MGK to be so important with respect to burden of proof, weighing the stability of the child's relationship against the parental rights and interests in wanting to raise their own child, the parental rights were overcome by the stability issues for the child, these various evidentiary matters that that I just raised with you. With respect to the law of the case argument, I think that the law of the case is that this was a permanent guardianship. That's what the order says. That's what the magistrate read out to Alan Sidman in the portions that we've quoted to the court. The law of the case was not that this would be a temporary guardianship. The law of the case was not that they could just come back, remove their consent, and get the child back.
The consents themselves stated that they were a temporary guardianship.
They had written that in. That's correct. Right. And then it was noticed for a hearing with proper notice, all in the record, that for a hearing on permanent guardianship. At the beginning of that hearing, the magistrate actually asked the parties present, at that point it was myself and the guardians, if we would consent to his appearing as running the case as a magistrate, hearing the case as a magistrate. Alan Sidman was supposed to be present by telephone. The court called, this is in the record, and was not able to reach Alan Sidman. It's like someone coming into a hearing 10 or 15 minutes late. They miss a certain part of the hearing. That doesn't mean that the court goes and redoes it for them.
Well, on that point, since that's a separate argument and asserted a jurisdictional argument, would you comment on that? Because the record certainly doesn't indicate that there was a specific consent by the father or the mother to the magistrate handling the guardianship issues.
I will. I'll make one last comment on the law of the case portion. It's discretionary, and the language that Mr. West has relied upon would be dicta, not the actual law of the case, which was that it was a permanent guardianship. On the jurisdictional issue, the probate code, sections 1514.106, grants the district court subject matter jurisdiction over guardianship proceedings, and 1514.200 exec gives the district court subject matter jurisdiction over guardianships relating to minor children, such as this one. The guardianship was by consent in 2001. It may not be that the consent said, gee, I'll let this magistrate make the ruling, but the guardianship itself was still by consent. It wasn't challenged until 5 years later, 2006. The decision on appeal to maintain the guardianship was also by a district court magistrate who gave the advisement and was by consent.
You would term that unconditional consent, or was it a conditional consent?
The consent to the guardianship or the consent to
the guardianship?
The consent initially, it was sent out as a consent to a guardianship, and it was handwritten in, they consented to a temporary guardianship. It was then noticed for a hearing on permanent guardianship. And the hearing itself was for a permanent guardianship. There was no reason given other than that it would be too traumatic for the mother to participate in that hearing. And the father chose to participate by telephone.
The question is, does there have to be not a consent to the guardianship, but a separate consent to the handling of the matter by the magistrate? And if so, is that a matter of subject matter jurisdiction?
The Supreme Court rules provide that there needs to be a consent to the magistrate. They also provide for waiver. And I would argue in this case, the consent to have it heard by a magistrate was waived. The mother did not appear. Now, the rule that was in time at that time, clearly she waived her right by not appearing. And that was a part of the rules for magistrate. The father was not available at the designated time. So when the magistrate asked the questions, he was not there to be able to give his answer. And so I would argue he waived it by not being available at the designated and appointed time when the magistrate tried to call him, and he was not available. Consent ultimately was granted when the hearing was heard, and I believe that these are rules of process, not of jurisdiction. Rules of subject matter jurisdiction go to the jurisdiction of the court, in this case the district court, to hear guardianship matters, in this case the guardianship of a minor. As to which judicial officer will hear that, I believe that's rules of process, And that process, if there was a violation, was waived. And that's our position on this. If you don't do that, then you've got the potential for every time a magistrate hears a case and someone doesn't object, the fact that the magistrate either may have forgotten to give the advice or may have given the advice and then someone walks in later. Multi-party cases occur all the time, both in juvenile and in guardianship cases. Magistrates give their advice, somebody walks in later, they say, well, I never got it, I was late. It was given. The fact that consent is necessary, that advisement was given in this case. And Mr. Sidman was late in his appearance. He called in late. This issue was not raised before the district court. I realize that if you rule that it's subject matter jurisdiction, it can be raised at any time. But the parties in this case waited 5 years, just like the mother in MJK, a subsidiary issue in that case. But the mother in that case said she wasn't given notice of the proceedings at the very beginning. And therefore, she felt that that was improper. And the court, the panel that heard that case said no. Any procedural violation was waived. So I would argue that this does not go to subject matter jurisdiction, which would deprive the court of its jurisdiction. With respect to the cross appeal, we filed the cross appeal. You know, I didn't write the brief at the time. I've taken over as counsel. But the cross appeal was filed to preserve the evidentiary issue in the event of a remand, in case that should happen, because there was no advance notice of any kind that this treating psychologist or psychiatrist was going to give an opinion that the mother was fit to parent. Mr. Rahman, who was trial counsel, objected when the question was asked. The court asked to lay a foundation. The psychiatrist laid a very minimal foundation, then gave his opinion. And the court said she would reserve ruling. The court didn't rule that it was admissible. The court said she would reserve ruling on the objection. Never did actually rule on it, but simply said, oh, I find the mother is fit. If there was advance notice, then the issue of the fitness and her mental condition and determining whether she's had more psychotic breaks and disclosure of her medical records and current condition could have been put at issue, would have been put at issue had I been trial counsel, and I imagine Mr. Rahman would have. But that was never disclosed. CRS 1514-109 says rules of civil procedure shall apply. And those rules should include proper expert disclosure. This expert had a little two-paragraph summary of what he was going to say, and it didn't include any opinion or indication that he was going to testify that psychologically she would now be a fit parent. There's so much more that goes into that in terms of her relationship with the child, the time spent with the child, never spending an overnight with this child since the child left her care 9 years ago. The child not looking to her as a parent, the amount of time that she hasn't spent out in Colorado visiting the child. There's so many issues that might go into that. Lastly, I have very little time left, but on the CCRS case and the concept of special weight, the CA case is easily distinguishable. CA case deals with a parental visitation statute, and it deals with a custodial parent who makes a decision. And the courts have held you have to give special weight to that situation. We're not dealing here with custodial parents. The CCRS case, the Supreme Court was dealing with a psychological parent and a natural parent. And they felt that the best interest standard is the appropriate standard. We use that standard in adjudicatory hearings in dependency and neglect cases. We use it in guardianship proceedings. We use it in custody cases. And something I need to point out, the MJ case, and I'll finish in a moment, the MJ case not only said the best interest standard is appropriate in consideration of termination of guardianships, but they said that the shifting of the burden of proof to the guardians or the custodians, because that was a mixed case. Some of the children were under guardianship or some were under custodianship, was inappropriate. And if they wanted to change, if the mother wanted to change the custodial arrangement under the parental responsibility statute, she'd have to meet an endangerment standard, much higher than the standard that was put to the guard to the parents in this case. And it's certainly indicative that...
expired.
Okay, thank you.
I want to be real clear.
Bailiff, why don't you put an extra minute on Mr. West's time?
Thank you, Judge. I want to be real clear. I think the best interest of the child standard applies here. But the best interest of the child standard when you're dealing with a parent and a non-parent has to be applied in a particular way. And that includes giving a presumption to the parent's wishes, and that includes putting the burden of proof on the non-parents. I've never claimed that the best interest of the child standard doesn't apply. It does. As far as advance notice of opinion, the record speaks for itself. I would say that Mr. Finkelstein is not being trial counsel. There was an opinion. That opinion was put into what he was going to testify to, and that's what he testified to. As far as Mr. Sidman showing up late, if you read the transcript, what happened is Mr. Finkelstein tells the judge, hey, Judge, we need to get Mr. Sidman on the phone. Let's do that. And the judge says, well, let's start with a couple things first. And then they call him. And then they ask for the consent. Right after that, they ask, do the guardians consent to the judge hearing this? So he didn't show up late. The judge didn't want to call him yet because he wanted to get consent from him. So I don't think that's accurate. Mr. Finkelstein spent a lot of time talking about the facts of this case. The facts aren't necessarily what's important here. I didn't appeal saying the judge didn't have any factual support for her findings. I said she applied the wrong standard. And we can go through all those facts, but I don't think that's real relevant for day-to-day's purposes. I guess I understood to say that, gee, even if we're right and there's a presumption in my client's favor, you can look at the record and decide that there was enough evidence either way, and it's a harmless error argument. I don't think that's the dysfunction of this court. The function of this court, as I understand it, or have always understood it, is to say, make sure that trial courts apply the law correctly. They didn't. If you determine that the trial court did not apply the law correctly, then it needs to be remanded back to them to apply the law correctly, and not for you to make determinations of fact based on the record. And with that, that's all I have. I appreciate the extra minute, but I apparently didn't need it.
Thank you, Mr. West. Thank you, Mr. Finkelstein. The case is now submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course. That completes our docket for today for Division 6. So the court will adjourn, and the bailiff should so announce.